Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Arnold Lane had a strange.
The man who wrote Pink Floyd's first hit remains one of rock's strangest, saddest stories. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today a new biography aims to clarify the legend of musician Syd Barrett. Plus, the Oxford-educated indie folk band Stornoway joins us to play from their album, The Beachcomber's Windsill, live in our studio. But first, Syd Barrett stopped making music in the early 1970s. He died in 2006. But the fascination with his songwriting ability and his tragic life seems endless. This year alone, we've seen a new box set of his music and a new biography called A Very Irregular Head, The Life of Syd Barrett. The book's author is Rob Chapman, who also writes for Mojo Magazine and other publications, and Rob joins us from the studios of the BBC in Manchester, England. Rob, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, Joe.
I have to ask, why so many years after he essentially left the music scene are we still finding people inspired to release books and box sets of Syd Barrett's music?
It's a fascinating life. Just the short period of creativity in itself is interesting, followed by 30 years of reclusive living and mystery and lots of myths to be dismantled.
You talk about myths that need to be dismantled. You are the first biographer of Syd Barrett since his death and the first to actually have the cooperation of his family. So how important, what were you able to get at that we haven't heard before?
I'm not the first person to get the cooperation of the family, but I think I'm the first person to actually sort of engage their trust so that they would talk to me in a way that they haven't other people. And Rosemary, his sister in particular, gave me quite an insight into those years after Syd left the Pink Floyd. So if we're working backwards with this story here, he goes back to Cambridge finally in 1982 after living reclusively in London for 5 or 6 years. And essentially, you know, going fairly mad, and arrived back in Cambridge at his own sister's words, a very damaged person and a very unrecognisable person from the Roger Barrett who first went off to London in 1964, a fresh-faced young art student.
Mm-hmm. Roger, of course, being his given name.
His given name.
Let me tell you the story as I've heard it. I mean, we're now like several generations of musicians and music writers removed from his early days with Pink Floyd, but let me give you the thumbnail sketch as I've heard it, and then you can tell me what's wrong or what's missing from the story. Syd Barrett appears on the scene swinging London mid-60s. He starts the band Pink Floyd, you know, sort of creates this wild psychedelic sound, and then lives the psychedelic lifestyle with equal gusto, you know, too much acid. He becomes really, you know, this kind of unreliable character. Eventually he gets kicked out of his own band, cuts a couple of solo discs, and then disappears into an attic somewhere in London before going off to live with his family. What's missing from this story?
Well, yeah, that's the shorthand version, and what's missing is the nuance. For starters, you see, I didn't want to begin the story with Syd as a fully formed creative individual in 1966 at the height of the London flower power scene. Syd did his art apprenticeship, and in fact, a lot of the techniques and ideas that he incorporated into his music came from his art training. Syd was first and foremost a painter, and he wanted to be a painter, and in many ways, he got kind of sidetracked into music, did it for 2 or 3 years, decided he didn't like it, and left. At the peak of his fame, as you say, yeah, you're absolutely right, 1966-67, the Pink Floyd were the darlings of the underground. They were English psychedelia personified, and arguably Syd, you know, virtually invented that particular sound, not single-handedly, but you know, he's the main person.
Mm-hmm.
Once this Pink Floyd became famous and once obligations set in and they had to be pop stars and act like pop stars, Syd started playing up and obviously didn't want it. Drugs are involved, obviously. Yeah, drugs are one of the factors. And I haven't set out to write an entirely revisionist history of the Pink Floyd that would somehow deny that LSD played any part of it. Of course it did, but it wasn't the only factor. There was a very complex and troubled young man there, and I think if you throw LSD into the mix at some point in that, then that's, you know, a cause for problems. But all of his friends who he grew up with all said to me that, you know, Sid, even before all that, there was a side of him that was kind of, you know, a bit strange and a bit, even at 16 or 17 years old, he could be detached and he could shut himself off. And some of those things were there from quite early on.
Well, and even his early hits. I mean, Arnold Lane, the song that we began the show with, a very strange subject for a pop hit, you know, a cross-dressing man. Or another early Pink Floyd hit, See Emily Play, has this kind of, you use the word detached. This has always struck me as a song with a certain almost zen-like detachment in its telling of its tale. This is a little bit from the early Pink Floyd and See Emily Play.
Emily tries but misunderstands. She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow. There is no other day. Let's try it another way. You'll lose your mind and play. Free games play. See Emily play. Emily cries, gazing through trees in sorrow, hardly a sound till tomorrow.
Sid Barrett and his band of the time, Pink Floyd, See Emily Play, a song from the mid-60s that became the second hit for the band. We're talking with Rob Chapman, the author of the new book, A Very Irregular Head, The Life of Sid Barrett. In amongst this tale of a meteoric rise and an almost equally sudden fall and then this long period of seclusion, you go to great pains, Rob, to talk about the songwriting. And, you know, a little bit later on in See Emily Play, you know, the verse about put on the gown that touches the ground, float on the river forever and ever. There's something very ominous, very Eastern, perhaps, about this. Was he part of that whole scene, you know, the Beatles looking to India, transcendental meditation and all that kind of stuff?
To a certain extent, but I think it's more to do with the English Arcadia. I think those images that you talk about are rooted entirely in Victorian childhood literature, in Lewis Carroll, in Edward Lear. I mean, the verse you cited begins, soon after dark, Emily cries, you know, gazing through trees in sorrow, hardly a sound till tomorrow. Well, you can imagine that, I think, as I said in the book, on a woodcut, on an illustration, maybe, from a Victorian childhood literature. And yes, he pursued Eastern literature to a certain extent, and there's a song on the first album based entirely on the words of the I Ching, chapter 24. But really, I didn't set out to write a rock and roll biography because I don't think it's a typical rock and roll life, and I don't think Sid's influences generally lie within rock and roll, apart from a certain obligation to Bo Diddley and his guitar playing fairly early on. I think almost all of his influences, lyrically and musically, lie outside of rock and roll, and it's more to do with... It's the difference between English psychedelia and American psychedelia, actually. I mean, American psychedelia, I think, was much more informed by the political situation and as a much more radicalized form of psychedelia, apart from maybe White Rabbit and a few things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. English psychedelia got in touch with its... Well, as Derek Taylor said of the Beatles, when they took LSD, they got in touch with their inner scouser and started writing songs about meter maids, you know. And it's the same with Sid. He goes, you know, he gets in touch with his inner Cantabrigian and starts writing about cross-dressing transvestites and, you know, and stuff like that. Cross-dressing transvestites is a tautology, of course. But, you know,
you
that,
wrote a lot about animals as well, you know, terrapins and octopi and things
like
that.
Well, he did, yeah. His dad was an amateur botanist. Apart from being a sort of an eminent pathologist as a doctor, his hobby was, you know, going out and collecting flora and fungi and sketching animals. And you're quite right. I mean, I did actually a kind of species count, you know, in the book. I actually laboriously went through all of the songs. And, yeah, you know, I mean, the effervescing elephant, it's all in there. The tigers, lions, the lot. You know, there's a veritable zoo full.
Even the title of that first Pink Floyd record, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, where does that come from?
That comes from the most mystical chapter in Kenneth Graham's The Wind in the Willows. Actually, the last chapter that he wrote, The Wind in the Willows is mainly a sort of story about all the animal folk. And then he writes this very pantheistic chapter where, you know, the animals do sort of commune with nature, with God. And Sid took the title from that. So that's, you know, that's a very telling phrase to actually take the most mystical spiritual chapter from that book. You see, that's where Sid's spiritualism came from, I think, more than Zen in the East.
So he's part of this psychedelic scene. As you say, he's a central figure in the formation of the scene. At some point, though, it comes back and it really bites him in the ass, doesn't it? I mean, he's having trouble, you know. You said he didn't want it in terms of fame. Was it that he didn't want it or that he didn't have the tools to handle the sudden acclaim, the television shows, the relentless touring and things like that?
It's a bit of both, and he hadn't thought it through. I don't think he's thought clearly about what fame would do to the band. Now, Roger Waters was actually a much more ambitious person, and Roger wanted fame for the band. And in many ways, you know, to be fair to the rest of the Pink Floyd, you can say, well, you know, that's the game they're in. That's the life they've chosen, to quote from The Godfather, you know. Sid was the one who just thought, you know, there was a kind of pure artist in Sid. I know Rick Wright mentioned this a few times before he died. He'd come to the conclusion that maybe what was going on there with Sid was a kind of purity of the form. And he didn't want to be dealing with press conferences and the obligations to do interviews and stuff like that, you know.
Well, there's a famous story of Pink Floyd playing this song, Apples and Oranges, on American Bandstand in 1967. Apart from a question that you raise in the book of what were Pink Floyd doing on the Pat Boone Show and American Bandstand and stuff, there's a story here. Let's hear a little of the song, and then I want you to tell us what actually happened.
Sunshine Town, feeling very cool. Met the butchers and the bakers and the supermarket stores, getting everything she wants from the supermarket store. She trips up sweetly to meet the people. She's on time again. And then I catch her by the eye. Then I stop and have to think what a funny thing to do, 'cause I'm feeling very big.
Apples and oranges.
Okay, so that's Apples and Oranges. Sid Barrett writing, singing, playing guitar, leading the band Pink Floyd. 1967, they come to the States, Rob Chapman, and they, quote-unquote, perform this song on American Bandstand. And again, the story is, I've heard it down through the years, is that Sid stands there on stage doing nothing. He doesn't lip-sync the way he's supposed to. He just kind of, like, stares vacantly into space. What's the real story?
Yeah, and for many years that was believed. Yeah, they're lip-syncing it, in fact, the whole band of miming, as bands usually used to at that time. And, of course, thanks to the wonders of YouTube and all this great archive retrieval we have now, you can see quite clearly the clip that's showed up on YouTube is that Sid is still lip-syncing some of the song, but then he does stand staring blankly at the camera for other parts of it. But he's not zombie-eyed and in a kind of vegetable state. There's a certain twinkle in the eyes. If he, you know, you can see him standing there saying, I'm not going to participate in this. I'm not going to stand here pretending to mime my music. And this is a period when everybody else was still prepared to mime their music. This is a time when the Cream would go on American TV and wield tennis rackets while they're doing a version of Anyone for Tennis, you know? And actually, I think Sid was ahead of the game. People like Led Zeppelin came along 2 years later and said, yeah, we're not going to mime. We're not going to take part in any of this charade, you know? And I think Sid was ahead of the game there. He was the first person to say, no, I'm not going to do this. But you see, for 30 years before we had YouTube and all this archive stuff reappearing, everyone would say, oh yeah, Sid stood with his arms slumped by his side. And there are lots of instances of that that I've addressed directly in the book and said, well, here's the archive and here's the actual recording, and he seems to be playing perfectly, you know, okay to me, you know. There are several other examples of that. Dick Clark asks them a few banal questions at the end, but Sid answers politely in that nice Cambridge polite middle class way of his, you know.
The book is called A Very Irregular Head, The Life of Sid Barrett, and the life of Sid Barrett is much more than Pink Floyd. As you said before, his time with the band is, in the general scheme of things, a pretty short one. He becomes this notorious, unreliable figure to the rest of the band. They're plotting to bring in David Gilmour to replace him. They eventually do a couple of gigs and forget to pick him up. And so what occasions this fall? How was it sudden? Was it gradual? What really happened?
I mean, the fall from the band, you mean, or the fall from creativity?
Well, they're sort of linked, aren't they?
Yeah, but, I mean, because he was messing things up and they were ambitious and they wanted to do it right, they had no choice but to get somebody in the end. I mean, I'm quite sort of rational about that. I'm not an apologist for Sid to say, well, what were they thinking? What were they doing? You know, it's like, no, Sid was messing up. He had to go. And they tried incorporating him into the band and they tried working as a five-piece for a while, but it didn't work. So Sid kind of went off into the wilderness. You can argue about their motives. They certainly had a lot of collective guilt about it for many, many years, and they would be the first to admit that they didn't do it well. I mean, just not to go and fetch the guy to say we're doing a gig, particularly when Rick Wright was actually living with Sid at the time. I mean, that took some explaining away. I'm just popping out, Sid. You know, like to
I'll
Belgium.
Be back in 3 days.
I'll be back in 3 weeks. They were going off to Belgium and Holland to do a tour after those first few gigs. But then after that, you know, Sid did a few solo records. And to be honest, the Pink Floyd did help out on both of the solo LPs. So you can't apportion blame directly. It wasn't a cutthroat thing. It was inevitable in the end. And it was the same, if you like to draw a parallel with Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys. You know, the main guy in the band is suddenly the least functioning guy in the band. What do? You know, you carry on without them.
Well, in Pink Floyd's case, they wrote many songs. I mean, the whole album, Wish You Were Here, is basically an ode to Sid Barrett, who was still very much with us back in those days. David Gilmour, as you write in the book, made sure that he got, you know, his royalties, which were substantial. So they sort of seem to have taken care of him from afar. What else? I mean, who else was taking care of him once he left the band and cut these two solo records? What did he do for the rest of his life?
Well, the management guys, Jenner and King, tried to look after him as well. They tried to get him back in the studio, even one last time in 1974 when it was hopeless, you know, and he obviously wasn't functioning as a musician anymore. But he has, in short, he has 5 years of quietly going mad in Chelsea Cloisters, not an attic, indeed, a mansion suite at the top end of the King's Road in Chelsea. And then he walked back to Cambridge, a story that I did think was a myth for many years, but that is one of the ones that actually happened.
He walked from Chelsea?
From London back to Cambridge.
Wow.
Yeah, in the early 80s. And for a while, he was still a very damaged person. He did spend some time in institutions voluntarily in the early 80s. And what he did in the end was he got back in touch with his original creative force, which was painting. He did reclaim his kind of artistic roots. He went back to being creative, not in any sense that you would understand a professional painter would be, but, you know, probably for therapy as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. But sometime in the late 80s, he started painting again, and indeed painted prolifically for the rest of his life. Was painting, in fact, up until literally days before he died. And those paintings, when you look at them now, some are good, some are just Sunday painter stuff, because he never finished his apprenticeship. He was, the saddest thing about the Sid story is that he was cut adrift, and he cut himself adrift from his own creativity. And it's like in any other walk of life, if you do that, you can never quite get back to that place you were at in your head when you were 22, you know?
Yeah. Rob, one of the sad things about this, and it's ironic that this is sad because this is a guy who didn't die young, but when you think of, say, for example, Nick Drake, another gifted young English songwriter who did die very young. Nick Drake is forever frozen in amber as this young, thin, good-looking, gifted poet slash musician. Sid Barrett lived another, you know, number of decades getting balder and fatter and, you know, just not looking the part and sort of becoming this kind of siren to a whole bunch of tabloid photographers who would follow him as he went out on his bike and bought his groceries and stuff. It really seems like he was dealt the worst of both hands, you know?
Yeah, he was. And Cambridge is a fairly small place, you see. So, I mean, if you're cycling around Cambridge, you're highly visible. And so he was seen quite frequently, and he was papped occasionally. And people who maybe should have known better, people who would call themselves fans, but, you know, they're borderline stalkers, would actually turn up at his house hoping for, I don't know what, his nephew Ian said to me, what did they think, you know, that the Sid of 1967 would come to the door and say, hey, come on in, let's take some acid, you know. That's what Ian, his nephew, said to me. You know, what did these people expect? And of course, the reality is, as you know, is far more mundane, isn't it? If you do live a long life, as you're not preserved in aspect, like you say, like Nick Drake, by, you know, dying young and leaving a good looking, you know, corpse and a good looking legacy, Sid retires to mundanity. He just potters around. He goes to the hardware store, he goes to the supermarket, and he turns into that balding old guy, still dressing immaculately. If you see any of those pap photos, apart from the odd one where he's shambling around down to the shops in his vest, you know, and hey, you know, we all have the divine right to go down to the shops in our, you know, in our painting clothes, you know, what's the problem, you know? But Sid generally carried on being a sharp dresser, you know. That's one thing that should be remembered.
Well, and another thing is the musical legacy, which, you know, there are lots. I mean, we have the band Stornoway coming in to play for us in a few minutes, and they are big Sid Barrett fans, and they're much younger.
I recognize that that drawl, that well-spoken whine, as it's called, in the voice. I recognize that's recognizably Sid, yeah.
Well, the book is called A Very Irregular Head, The Life of Sid Barrett. The author is Rob Chapman, who's been with us from the studios of the BBC in Manchester, England. Rob, it's a fascinating life and a story well told. Thank you for telling some of it for us today on Soundcheck.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Later Pink Floyd, post-Sid Barrett, but an album all about him. Wish You Were Here and the song Shine On, You Crazy Diamond. Up next, we'll hear about the 2011 Grammy nominees just announced last night. And then later, as just mentioned a moment ago, the band Stornoway. They combine PhD smarts with folk pop books, and as Rob Chapman just told us, perhaps an echo of Sid Barrett as well. And they will play live in our studio.
Until I fall.